Good evening again. After that performance in the fellowship hall, you think I don't have any training, but I'll show you that I do. Most everyone is introduced. Royalty are presented. So I present to you Dan Bagby. Come on up.
It's called premature disappointment, right? Daniel and I were comparing notes on different times when we said things we wish we could somehow turn back. And so I'll share with you because you won't tell anybody. No. Janet knows this. I was at a graveside for a professor of religion at Baylor, Wally Christian, a very wonderful person, graveside for his father, who was a minister of music. He was from another city. I did not know the father well. We're walking toward the graveside, and two or three people are trying to tell me how many children they had and who they were. And so I've got this in my head. And so the first thing I said in front of the son and two sons and a daughter was, Mr. Christian had three sons and a daughter, as far as we know. So from there on, you know. Life's not fair. We live by our humility. We acquire it if we didn't find it, right? You have a note on forgiving self and forgiving others. I do. I thought I would start today with forgiving self, looking at in the mirror. And then in the next Wednesday session, it is on either side, but I am going to start on the forgiving self side. And on the third Wednesday, if you're still here, we'll deal with. There's some up here and some back there, maybe? They're just a dollar and a quarter. I don't know why we ran out. I do want you to know I do not get any respect. Someone asked my wife 3 weeks ago, it started with the family, what she was giving up for Lent. And she said, Dan. It's been a long week. You probably know this is a collection of conversations over 35 years, I guess, because between a pastor twice, associate pastor, pastoral counselor and teacher a couple of times, and working at a prison system, I've listened to what people say along the way. So this is where it is. I thought I'd introduce it. Forgive me if in repeating what's down there already, I just interpret one or two words because I'd love to hear what you would say about it. A word of prayer as we start. Would you be with me? O dear one who has taught us grace, be present here that the time we spend may be in keeping with your will. Release us from oppression. Care for us as we learn from you and are sustained by you. And let our memories become the source of hope. Be with these folks, the people they love, the families that sustain us, and this church, that we may be of service to you through Christ. Amen. Here is what people have taught me, and I have learned myself about the greatest struggles we tend to have in regard to our capacity to forgive ourselves. Somewhere in our head, so much of this conversation is the interior conversation we have only with ourselves, sometimes shared with another, but that's why it will say, for something we never tried or never did, for something we never said, or for something we did say we wish we hadn't said, or somewhere along the way, something we did try we might not have. That's under number one, right? We rehearse these things, we remember, and we sometimes not only remember, but we continue to repeat them to the place that they become an enemy to hope, I think. Under number two, sometimes there's a tragic incident in our life or an event And we believe it has defined us for life. Isn't it an interesting experience of the myth in our head that we've concluded that one issue is our total definition of ourselves, and we cannot forgive ourselves for it. It's a struggle we have for that. Under number three, for repeating irresponsible behavior, something we've concluded is irresponsible, but issues in regard to either thoughts, obsession, or actions, behaviors, which is compulsion. As I've listened to people along the way as pastor and pastoral counselor, they have made promises that this would never happen again, that they would never do this again, that they would never say this again. And then in the process of that faltering, they give themselves one, two, or three times when they can still be forgiven. It's intriguing how we condemn ourselves and have our own set of numbers by how many times we can be forgiven before we are no longer forgivable. I've heard that over and over again. And folks who struggle with some forms of obsessions or addictions very often struggle with that particular issue, perhaps more than others. Under number four, we'd like to be people of the light, but when we know ourselves, we also know there's the shadow side. Several psychologists along the way have reminded us that there is the golden shadow and there is the darker shadow within us. And if no one else knows it, we know there are parts of us that are still unredeemed, selfish, focused on ourselves, self-focused, as some people speak of it. Parts we are not proud of that continue to be part of our journey. And they sometimes become for us what is most difficult to forgive, particularly when we listen to the possibility that we're supposed to get past that and be an example or a model of perfection. That's an interesting possibility, impossibility. Under number five, somewhere along the way, it's a parallel to issues we feel we have not fully paid for. We give ourselves particular condemnations. We give ourselves certain sentences. As a pastoral counselor at places where people were struggling with having done so much in reparation or remorse and still feeling stuck, I've asked them after other things failed, well, what kind of a sentence did you give yourself? Do you have to pay for this for 10 years? 20 years? Or do you have a life sentence? Because some people do not feel that they can ever be released in the experience of a lifetime. And so it's intriguing. Somewhere, if it's vague, it never gets released. Do you know what I'm saying? If it's not concrete, it keeps going, doesn't it? Number six, there are places and times. I still remember a pastor friend who accidentally ran over a child and killed her backing out of a car. The issue of reviewing and revisiting that experience and feeling that somewhere along the way that was irreparable and irreconcilable and in the process could never be forgiven for it. There are extreme issues, no doubt, that sometimes assail us. Under number seven, for abuses in which we have participated. I found it interesting that the group of chaplains who's in training in Richmond yesterday asked me to review different forms of abuse for them to be aware, but also talking with themselves about experiences out of the several generations that they've had. The issue of emotional abuse, often not identified one generation to another. Physical abuse, we're clear about. Sexual abuse, we talk about. Perhaps we talk least about spiritual abuse, but you and I recognize that there are toxic congregations and systems and people sometimes using authority to lord it over people. And folks who clearly repent from that struggle with what they have done, has it been the damage they feel, again, they cannot repair. Somewhere along the way, some people feel guilty for having participated in it. Under number eight, and we'll speak more about this in the third Wednesday we have. Somewhere along the way, if we've been taught that it was not right to be angry with God, though the psalmists were, we pause and wonder if it's unforgivable to have been angry with God. I think you perhaps have heard me say it before, when I listen often to people who've grown up in the church for a number of years and I ask them, well, what are you doing with anger toward God? Well, I'm not angry with God, I'm hurt, which is a euphemism for anger. But it's a challenge we have because for us, the perception it places, even in the Hebrew Bible, is that anyone who is angry will either be consumed or zapped or whatever we think of. Somewhere it seems to be the issue that we think separates us from the only one who can forgive. Number 9, sometimes very quietly, there were dreams along the way we didn't pursue. We cannot forgive ourselves for not having tried them or for places where they were abandoned. We started, did we give them enough energy or strength? And so we hear those questions, and as you can tell, our mind is playing all the time. And so that's perhaps the first place where the challenge of forgiving self takes place. Now and then, I hear some people, when we unpeel 3 or 4 conversations in their head, they wish they were someone else and cannot forgive themselves for not having gifts of someone else, rather than embracing who they are by the grace of God. And so they feel unforgiven for who they are. I hope that doesn't sound too strange to you. It occurs. The last one I have, and this is certainly not exhaustive, but the ones I've heard the most. Somewhere along the way, in the absence of a clear understanding of what the unforgivable sin is, we conclude for ourselves what it is and have decided somewhere that we were the ones who have committed it, and so we can't be released from that. I placed a note there between Judas and Peter. Several of you have heard me say this before. I think the only difference between Judas and Peter was that Judas could not forgive himself. Peter betrayed him just as much. And Peter went away back to fishing, remember? You remember the John story. Christ has to go find him because he's struggling with even being able to use the word love or agape. In the Greek, he's saying, I will be your friend, and Christ is asking him if he really loves him. And it's that three-portion part where Christ is trying to communicate and deliver grace and forgiveness. Sometimes we interrupt the conversation so that it never happens, and those are the issues I have most heard, and forgive me for just reviewing them with you, because you would add words or thoughts as you would find them useful. Somewhere along the way, these seem extreme, but I've collected the toxic messages some people rehearse all day long inside their mind. If people really knew me, they would not like me, they would reject me. I make so many mistakes that I'm inadequate as a person. Self-esteem is a significant issue, isn't it? Under 3, I'm ashamed of something which has blemished me for life. It's part of the conversation or word we had earlier. Unless I can permanently conquer a weakness I have, I'm of no value. I don't know about you, but I've often wondered about Paul and what was the thorn in the flesh and whether it was a weakness he would try to conquer but never could. And whether he understood and accepted as he spoke about Christ, God's grace being sufficient for him. Was it in fact a repetitive event, behavior, or issue? I'll leave that for you to think about. And then some people feel if they fail in 1 or 2 primary relationships that they're a total failure. Somehow we feel unforgiven. Every fall, I'm over at First Baptist working with divorce recovery, and one of the significant recurring struggles some folks have, about 110 in a room, is whether they can be forgiven for a failed relationship, even though sometimes they were the least involved in its disappearance. And again, you know, what I've done is unforgivable, and I have to pay for it the rest of my life. When you ask someone, when I ask people what they've been saying to themselves, they often say nothing. And then I ask them to start thinking, start looking carefully at what, because you're talking to yourself the whole time. That's the seedbed for the struggle with forgiveness, I think, in regard to forgiving ourselves. because there is where we punish ourselves. And theologically, the question is whether or not we were designed and called by God, fallible and fragile as we are, to live lives of not just humility, but also significant pain, or if we can move by grace beyond them. How do we deal with that? So I've suggested some places where we heal. We need to acknowledge the struggle, recognize the wound. We do that better than moving on sometimes. Secondly, it's intriguing to see our requirement to punish ourselves. Somehow there are consequences to some things we've done, but we seem, of all things, to be the person who requires the most punishment when we look in the mirror. We struggle, we regret, we repent, we have a season of sadness, and hopefully we move through so that we don't have to relive the past. Part of the note I say somewhere along the way is, if we don't, we are condemned to repeat the problem, so that we, in fact, so infect our lives that we are not free to be of hope and grace in the future. There are some people who so condemn themselves, they're absolutely paralyzed from doing anything they believe is worthwhile. Did God want that? And of course, you would hear me say quite clearly, of course not. He says that as he looks. There's so many different places. But I still like the scripture later found in the New Testament where he looks at someone who has dehumanized herself. Where are your condemners? Neither do I condemn you. Go and sin no more. Move on. Stand and move on. Somewhere along the way, there are people who find it necessary to atone in particular ways. And if they have a tangible way to do it and it releases them, in the Baptist tradition, we don't have confession that releases somehow by doing certain things. That is our greatest struggle. It's so unclear as to how we can pay for what we may have done. And, of course, the perception that we always have to pay for it. So that's been a struggle along the way, and emotionally and spiritually. Part of what we need to remember is that we are not the sum of any mistake, sin, or issue, that we have much more to contribute, and the God of grace invites us always to start over, as God did as I read the Psalms and as I read other places, as God did with Israel over and over again, and one person after another, as you yourself, I think, find in the Bible. Well, that is why I'm a believer in embracing the future, not by bypassing whatever we're struggling with, but by facing it, acknowledging its struggle, allowing ourselves permission to understand what consequences we feel are appropriate for it, and then by grace moving on, because there are some things we cannot pay for. We simply receive, because that is the nature of forgiveness and grace. Well, you have been patient, and you're still here. Thoughts and comments. I didn't want to run through that, but I thought maybe if I interpreted it a little, it would start a dialogue. So glad to hear what you look at, consider, and evaluate as you think about the challenge of forgiving oneself. What think you?
What really struck me was number one in this second section, the common toxic messages we carry. If people really knew me, they would reject me. I think I've heard that message most in the context of inviting persons to church or inviting persons to church membership. And I think, if I'm honest, I've probably responded something like, oh, well, that's not true. You know, our church is loving and accepting, and we're not perfect, and we, you know, we're made up of imperfect people, and we'd love to have you. I'm wondering now whether that could be dismissive, perhaps, of an expression of pain or of difficult forgive. You know, I've as I say, I've sort of pushed it aside by saying, "Oh, don't worry about that. That's not true." Maybe they're saying less about us and more about themselves. You know what I'm getting at? That
I understand.
So maybe here's the question I'm finally getting to. With that context, how might we listen and respond? Because I think they are saying they're being confessional.
Mm-hmm. Taking something seriously about themselves. Well, and some of that may depend on where you and I are in terms of the conversation and the level of trust. In counseling, I feel free to say, well, tell me what you're struggling with so that I'll know more about what this is as an issue for you. Because very often we have no idea, you know, what it is that they're dealing with. In a situation where you're in a visitation and they don't know you as well, I think you can say, well, of course, any of us who are part of a congregation are very fallible people. Maybe sometime we need to talk about that. Is there particular things you want me to know about it? Which is an invitation. When I teach pastoral counseling, I always say, with Christ, we invite, we don't ever force. Because we may invite and someone else may be the person that they confess to or speak to or struggle with. So that's not always easy to do on a visit, you know, and place there. It's intriguing the kind of barriers that people create for themselves, isn't it, along the way.
Yeah. So what I hear you saying is rather than, you know, dismissing it, oh, that's not true, they've revealed something to you, take it seriously, and they've opened the door, maybe speak with them about it.
I think if you're in a position to do that, that would probably give them a better sense of what really they could process or trust you with or trust any of us with. Though we mean well, I think they feel sometimes we take lightly what we haven't even understood, you know. So
that's part of what I'm afraid of.
Part of the peace, isn't it? Yeah. Yeah. I'll not forgive you for not coming. No. I know it's an interesting ongoing experience, isn't it? Because we forgive ourselves in percentages, I think. We visit it, and then we revisit it, and then it comes again. Bill?
We recently had a friend who was going through a difficult time who talked about her anger at God and actually cursing God. And I think sometimes people can be who are listening to that can be very upset with that individual and think it's almost heresy, whereas it may give opportunity to bring that person healing because you become the listener for that. And I wonder if you would dialogue about that.
Yeah, that's very important. I've even heard people say, don't question God or don't be angry with God, which closes the conversation, right? As opposed to that, to inquire and invite more, I think, is helpful. Because they're struggling with unfinished business, you know, inside of their world. And I think the more we investigate, the better we discover that God's dialogue continues in those places. I'm having a memory of two people. parents whose children as adults committed suicide. The struggle and the challenge of that because they both were angry with God and feeling guilty themselves. And often when we think, I know I didn't have control, but God could have, that becomes a struggle. And to talk it through is part of the release that I think makes a difference. Because I don't think, that's why I repeat Romans 8 so often with folks, nothing now can separate us, you know. A beautiful passage, because I think some people have concluded that will separate them from, but they, and so I've interpreted that anger at God often is an expression of care. Some of you know I wrote a book on anger as care, because often we've assumed that it was in and of itself sin, when anger can be an expression of deep care. I care so much about what happened. I wanted you to change it, and you didn't. To hear that and to have that expressed becomes an opportunity for release and grace, I think. Is that part of what? Thank you. Good word. We revisit sudden events like that over and over and over again. That's why when someone is grieving a loss, you never have introduced their feelings when you ask them how they're doing. They're already doing their feelings. You help them by releasing some of their feelings. I don't know how to do life without grace. Judy.
Can you talk a little bit about how all of this forgiving self and the struggle, et cetera, that has walked people into the whole area of addiction? And I've seen a lot doing women's health, and also people not feeling good about themselves, and so they keep trying to do things to themselves to feel better.
Mm-hmm.
So a physical thing, whether it's an addiction, how does all this weave in the world?
Doing things to feel better, you're saying?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I think there are different motivations at different times for trying somehow to do something redemptive, you know, that is releasing. And there's the other side, too. When I was chaplain to the juvenile detention center, there was cutting. There were places where people were imposing physical pain upon themselves as somehow, let me find something that'll let me pay for what I've done or for what I think of myself, which is part of the challenge. The positive side, if it's not overwhelming, is when someone decides to do something positive out of the experience of a difficulty so that they're going to reverse. And you and I read those things, as long as it doesn't become a controlling thing, or theologically, so that it doesn't, for them, become, this is how I'm bargaining to find grace, because it's a never-ending dead end. Does that make any sense? Whenever I'm bargaining, it's my own sense of what I need to pay, and I don't know how to pay, and so it never ends, and it becomes a vicious circle. And so some people are not released, and that's the power, I think, of the fourth chapter in Luke and other places where Christ comes into the synagogue and said that he came to release the captives. We are captives to so much. And often it's a small view of ourselves, you know, to set at liberty those who are oppressed. That's what he came to do, you know. And the struggle the church has historically has been whether to deliver mainly judgment, or does consequence also have grace, you know. And are we all not part of the issue of grace? It's only by grace that we make it. You've heard me say before, these folks had been 3 years in graduate work with him. They're in the upper room, and when he says, one of you will betray me, each one of them says to themselves, is it I? Every one of them had thought of betraying him. Even after 3 years, it makes me feel a little better. Well, the times I have betrayed him and thought of betraying him. Do you know what I'm trying to say with that? Mm-hmm. I'm in the company, like Daniel was trying to say to a person who wonders if they can belong here. Oh, yeah, you know. Come and join the other sinners, right? Helpful word. Is there some lack of clarity with what I'm saying? Something you'd like to pursue because it was not... or something you'd like to add. Yes, Ed.
I'm thinking about the one, if people really knew me, they would reject me.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm trying to think of examples where our church fellowship has learned something about someone and been very gracious and loving and continued to be welcoming. And I'm also wondering if there have been times that we learned something about someone and then they paid a terrible price in the fellowship for
mm-hmm.
that.
Mm-hmm.
And if that latter situation isn't what would prevent some of us from being more revealing, mm-hmm. know, we don't want to be hypocrites, we want to be authentic persons.
Right.
But I'm just wondering if that's an area of growth for the church in general and us as individuals, to be a little better at being gracious and forgiving of people who have not been perfect.
Mm-hmm. No doubt about it. And that's a struggle because there are some things we find easier to forgive than others. You know, there's a list of what is more forgivable, we think. In some cases, it's more of a personal issue, and we struggle with that. Next week, when we talk about forgiving others, one of the comments I make, which one or two of you have heard me make before, is that sometimes people think to forgive someone for some wrong they have committed is to return them to the level of trust they've had before. And so they struggle with even entering the dialogue because that's so hard to do. Part of what I will say, so you don't have to come back next week. Part of what I will say is that forgiving someone else does not mean returning them to the level of trust they have already not been capable of, but returning them to another level of trust, which is still a relationship. There are a few times when we have to break a relationship, though at times that's necessary too. But I think that's one of the struggles folks have. Does this mean then that you need to forgive me to the place that you don't care anymore about what I did and it doesn't matter? It does matter. And sometimes we have been so significantly betrayed that we need boundaries and we need more space and distance. I hope that's making some sense to you. But that is part of the struggle, because since we don't know what to do, sometimes we leave it in silence, and that silence doesn't communicate any form of reparation. It is a struggle, isn't it, along the way. I found it intriguing how he had trouble with Pharisees, and yet he had lunch with them. And it was Pharisees who said, you know, Herod's out to get you. I found that intriguing along the way, you know. That was last Sunday, in case you missed it. You'll have to hear it. Two Pharisees were here. Okay. But the issue of grace and when it can be extended and who can extend it is another issue. Yesterday when I was talking about abuse, there is in family systems a conversation about cutoff. There are places where family members or a member have been so abusive that cutoff is essential, because there are no boundaries where that person will not return to the abuse they've done before. I don't know if you're understanding what I'm saying. I'm saying that because at some point that can seem like and appear to be rejection of the person. It is the rejection of the behavior. But if some people cannot change their particular mistreatment and behavior, we need to set boundaries so that they cannot enforce it upon us. Do you know what I'm trying to say? Which means, sorry? Yes, because that'll require forgiving ourselves. And it's an experience of grief, Ray, as you know, because part of what we then deal with is the issue that we wish perhaps sometimes we could have a better relationship than we did. You've seen that in family relationships. And I've wondered that often in regard to Jesus Christ and the brothers who would not accept him and where he was with that, you know, and those kind of particular places. There are relational events we have that are destructive enough we should not be subjected to them in an ongoing fashion. That makes any sense?
What about kind of the idea that not forgiving yourself is kind of the only thing keeping you from backsliding into, or keeping the person from backsliding into what they feel like is an irresponsible behavior? Or if they forgive themselves, it kind of takes a weight off them, maybe they would sink back into it.
So that it gives them permission,
yeah,
to
whatever they thought was their irresponsible behavior, their weakness, or whatever.
And that is, Daniel said some interesting things tonight, so I'll speak about the underbelly of forgiveness, the other side of it. And in psychology, we speak of secondary gratification. There are places where we choose not to be forgiven in order to give ourselves the space we want to act as we have been before, you know. That is the case. And those are places where we need to look very carefully, you know, at ourselves. Some of you know that my doctoral dissertation was on the pastoral care of alienated church members. And one of the dynamics, not all of them, there were some people who were ignored. There were some people who were not cared for, and there were some people who were forgotten. But then there were some people who took an occasion to create a separation they wanted to keep. Secondary gratification. Because you did this, now I have permission no longer to be involved with the community of faith. That is why, as pastor, two or three times when I would visit people and they'd tell me about their wound, I'd say, well, it probably is difficult for you to be back to, and this didn't happen here, River Road Church. What about Trinity Church, you said you... And so I'll mention two or three, and I usually knew the pastors, and then they're a little, you don't mean you don't want me there? I didn't say that. I said, I want you to be in the community of faith somewhere where you can be useful so that your gifts and talents are not ignored and lie in waste. And make, you know what I'm saying? Good word. Why did you look at me when you were talking about that? No. I'm not paranoid, right?
Maybe some of what Daniel has had to deal with too, because I know, you know, that it seems like there are some people that are members of our church that don't ever come and really don't have any intention of coming, but still are on the roll, and you want to try and encourage them to get involved and to be active, and it's trying to figure out, well, was there something that happened that, you know, caused them to turn away, or is it just life for them?
And there are legitimate experiences where people have what I call the unfinished business. They have been wounded and nobody tended to them. And part of the confession of a pastor, as I have done, is to say, it looks like we failed you, and I am so sorry. I'm remembering a lady whose son was arrested, and this is, now I'm in Texas, and nobody came to help, and there was a sense that nobody was undergirding the family. Of course, they didn't know it very much, but for 5 or 6 years then, they wanted nothing to do with the church. And I think there are places where we, as a community, need to confess, we have failed you, and I hope that doesn't mean you write us off, but I do want to say it sounds like we were not responsible in the covenant we had with you. Paul.
What is the bridge to teach grace to a non-Christian?
What is the
bridge to teach grace to a non-Christian?
Well, and I would think there are probably several, and in terms of offering the grace of God to a non-believer, I think I would start with whatever struggle they have and how do they see themselves and what particular value they have and what particular concerns they have, and then ask them whether they have ever joined a community of faith, and then say to them, the only reason I'm part of the community of faith is because, imperfect as I am, I've been graced, and I want to make a difference and serve God in other ways, and I, you know, in ways by my imperfection that can still be useful. That starts a conversation sometimes. Is that what you're asking, though?
Yeah, they don't have the understanding and comprehension.
Right. And then there's another group of people that has what I would call a toxic understanding. One of my favorite ways of working with juvenile detention, you know, I'd go down walking opposite side of 17-year-old, and they'd say as they went by, just to see if they could, you know, start a conversation, I don't believe in God. And I would pause and say, what kind of God do you not believe in? And then when they'd tell me, I'd say, I don't believe in that kind of God either, and I walked away. So now they're walking behind me. So what kind of God do you believe in? Aren't there some awful images of who God is? And that's one of the struggles. So sometimes we're doing repair work, and other times it's brand new work. So completely different conversations in some ways, right? For what it's worth. I promised I would stop at 7:02 and take an offering.
Are there a couple other questions? We're having such good discussion, I don't want to cut it off. I've got a couple more, but you know, I can. If you need to leave, if you can stay a couple more minutes, Dan. I know we might have some other questions. I've just been struck tonight by the power of confession as, I don't want to say empty ritual, but almost ritualistic in terms of our ability to seek healing and forgiveness. And I wonder about our Protestant discomfort with hearing confession, whether there might be a way to recover a sacred responsibility, I think, of counselors to say, this is a safe place, lay it out. You won't hurt me, you won't offend me. Let me hear it.
And there are two places here in this congregation where you get it in a worship experience, a prayer of confession. Mm-hmm. Then when you come to the table, we have confessed, and you say, by the grace of God, mm-hmm. you are forgiven. Those are the two rituals here that I identify most. They'll be in a sermon also. But those are recurring issues, if that makes any difference, because Baptists don't have a structured way for that to occur very often. That's why we do need prayers of confession, mm-hmm. you know. But yeah. Just to start, did you want to say more?
That's a good moment to do it in worship. We do it jointly. And you're right. Before we take the first bite of communion, we confess our sin to God and to one another. And part of that unison is not to hear everybody's business, but to realize we all have things for which to confess. And from my perspective, in that assurance of pardon, it's not the priest offering forgiveness, but on behalf of, as one with the microphone, on behalf of us all, let us forgive one another. And after that, it's not that we will not sin anymore, but we are in a place to commune with Christ in a new way. And in a sense, we have that clean slate with God and with one another.
And the challenge of that, of course, is that it's very brief and it's more abstract than concrete. Mm-hmm. Roman Catholics have some concreteness to that, and yeah. It can get abused, obviously, and has been so.
Yeah.
Well, may I share one story and I'll quit? I was in Edinburgh, Scotland, at a Presbyterian congregation where, because I was not the Presbyterian, they had a visiting minister administering communion, and I was holding the bread, and they come forward. By the way, they had tokens, little silver tokens you brought to indicate. The deacons had been by and dropped them off at the houses, and you brought your token in to say you were there. But, and one or two have heard this, but probably one of the most powerful things for me was this lady in her 80s who came up, and she was going to take the bread, like everybody, because they came forward, and then she pulled her hand back. And I'm just holding the bread, and I don't know her, but he knows her, retired minister. So the second time, she went that way, and she still stopped. And then he leaned over, and he called her by name, and he said, "Take it, Jane. It's for sinners."
Oh, my goodness.
And she took it then.
Makes that folks who take communion every time they worship, they're on to something. We need that, and we need that reminder that we are forgiven, and that doesn't make it a lot easier to forgive ourselves. But thank you, Dan, for being here tonight. This, you may be aware, arose out of something Bill Tuck was teaching us about. This concept of forgiveness was just a rich, we probably usurped what he wanted to teach us that night, but the conversation really went there, that we thought, let's talk about this some more. So I do hope you'll come back as we continue this forgiveness theme. We need to talk about it, because I'm certainly no expert on it, and maybe you're not either, but Let's close our time with a prayer. At the end of this day, Lord, for the things that we have done that have grieved you, for the things that we have not done which have grieved you, certainly for the ways we have grieved our brothers and sisters and the ways we have grieved our own selves and our own spirits, forgive us as we seek to be generous with our forgiving of others, just as you have never been stingy with forgiveness upon us. Amen. Thank you very much. We'll see you Sunday, if not before.